Chapter 5.
"Well, I don't know quite what to say," said Ailsa, clearly upset. "One tries to keep the past in its place, especially when we all congregate here every year. This has brought it back as though it all happened yesterday, not 50 years ago."
"Yes, it must be so hard," replied Symington. "That's why we came to tell you now, instead of leaving it until morning. Sad to say, connections are bound to be made locally."
"Not much doubt about that," Daly added.
"And these remains, how likely do you think it's—"
"A forensic team is at the site now, Mrs. Shannon. The skeleton will have to be taken to the lab in Glasgow, if we can make any kind of identification, and that is by no means guaranteed. We'll inform you as soon as we have the details."
Symington reached across to hold the old woman's hand.
"This may be some sick prank, or completely unconnected to the disappearance of your son. I'm sorry that you have to go through this."
Daly, admiring the way his new superintendent was handling the awkward situation, was quietly observing Ailsa. Though he knew her age, he found it hard to believe she was an octogenarian. She had grey hair, cut and styled in a modern fashion, though not out of keeping with her age. She was tanned, slim and fit, her clothes understated yet elegant, and despite news of the gruesome discovery, she remained composed, her bright green eyes focused on Symington, taking in every detail. He tried to imagine how she must feel, the loss of her son brought back in such an unpleasant way.
"I will inform the rest of the family tonight. As you say, there is little point in trying to keep anything like this quiet in Blan. We bring in extra staff, most of them local at this time of year, to help with numbers. I imagine the village, and Kinloch come to that, will be abuzz with this news already."
"Will there be a lot of people about?" asked Daly. "I had imagined that your meetings here were relatively small family affairs."
"Oh, the family, the board, are the focus of events. But nowadays, when you add on wives, children, grandchildren, personal staff, accountants, advisers, lawyers, etc., well, the whole thing has become rather a three-ringed circus."
"So it wasn't like this 50 years ago?" asked Symington.
"No, no. The family was so much smaller then. And, of course, Percy and his wife were much younger, so, apart from the couple of maids whom we brought with us, he and his wife coped with our requirements. So much better in many ways. But as I'm sure you know, Superintendent, times change, and rarely for the better, in my opinion."
"Is Percy the older gentleman who showed us up?" asked Daly.
"Yes. He's become an irascible old bugger." She smiled. "He and his wife should have retired years ago, but they don't want to, and since they've become such an institution as far as the family is concerned, I dare say there'd be a wholesale revolt if they tried to—" "So, was this Percy—sorry, I don't know his surname—were he and his wife here when your son went missing?"
asked Symington, revealing some of the bluntness Daly had spotted earlier in the day.
"Percy and Morag Williamson, and most certainly they were here then. In fact, they've been here since Percy was in his 20s. In the past he was responsible for maintaining the house and gardens, while her preserve was cooking and housekeeping. Over time we've had to force them to wind down a bit. Now he mainly potters about, fixing things here and there, or riding about on the little lawnmower tractor we bought him. He's more of an odd-job man now. If anything of any consequence needs attention, we bring in contractors from Kinloch."
Ailsa inadvertently cast her eyes up to the large crack above the window as she said this.
"They live in the old cottage on the grounds. It's been their home for more years than I care to remember. Makes me feel my age."
"So basically the house is only occupied for a few days each year around this time?" asked Daly.
"Well, yes and no, Chief Inspector. The house is available to be used by family and friends throughout the year, but they all have such busy lives now and are more likely to spend their holidays in the Bahamas rather than Blan. One or two still come up in the summer, I try to visit each June. That's a lovely time of year here. And the bloody Bahamas are too hot for me.
So how many people will be in the house this new year?
As many as 60, perhaps more. We have the house itself and the annex that my husband built, she said.
So a considerable number. Quite an undertaking, I would imagine, said Symington.
Yes, Superintendent. Of course, there are some of my family who would much rather that this little tradition was dispensed with entirely.
Times change, I suppose, said Daly.
Your husband died quite young, I believe, Mrs. Shannon.
Yes, in his late 30s, I'm sad to say. He never got over the loss of our son, Archie. We had another child, but he never came to terms with whatever happened to his firstborn.
She looked at Daly sadly.
He started drinking heavily. I suppose the grief, along with running the business, was just too much to bear. I couldn't get close to him, latterly.
So he was in charge? Asked Symington.
Oh, yes, very much so. In many ways, despite his premature death, what he put in place were the foundations of what the company has now become. He was far-seeing in terms of investment and new opportunities. We made a move into minerals and oil at the right time when prices were cheap. He was a clever man.
So who runs the show now? Said Daly.
Well, we all have a say. After my husband's death, his younger brother took over as managing director. As the business became much more complex, we had to bring in expertise from the wider business community. Though my brother-in-law is still alive, he has been incapacitated for many years with dementia. His son, my nephew Maxwell, runs the business with a chief executive.
Daly noticed the look of disgust that crossed her face, and raised his brows.
"Goodness," said Ailsa, noticing his reaction. "Are my inner thoughts so transparent? Well," she laughed, "though my son and I still have a significant shareholding, we have been rather marginalized. Of course, much of the problem lies with him. Though Bruce, my son, has a keen business brain like his father, he shares the same demons."
"Meaning?"
"He assuages his frustrations with drink and goodness knows what else, Mr. Daly. He should be here now, but he's still in London. It's the curse of getting old. One's family becomes more and more troublesome and disappointing as the years go by, or so it would appear."
As if on cue, the door burst open to reveal a young woman, her bowed head shaded from the lights in the room. She looked to be in her late teens or early 20s, with dark, almost black hair cut into a bob with a heavy fringe. She lifted her face to look at Ailsa and the police officers, then started to moan, a quiet, low keening.
"Nadia, dear," said Ailsa, rising from her chair and hurrying over to the girl. "Hush now, there's nothing to worry about."
Seconds later, a woman wearing a plain blue dress arrived and gently took the girl by the arm.
"I apologize, Mrs. Shannon. Nadia is really unsettled tonight for some reason. I turned my back for a second." "Quite all right, Mrs. Watkins. I'll come and see you shortly. Nadia," she called as the girl was led away. "I must apologize. That was my granddaughter, Nadia."
Ailsa looked upset. "I hope she hasn't heard the news," said Daly.
"Oh, it's possible. She is perfectly intelligent, but sadly she suffers from a condition which affects the frontal lobe of her brain."
"How does that affect her?" asked Symington.
"She sees and hears things that aren't there, Superintendent."
The two men crouched amongst the ferns, shivering with cold as they watched the policeman in white overalls working under the lights in the glade. The smaller man squinted at the scene.
"How close do you have to be to get a decent image, Brocky?"
he whispered to the man beside him, who was looking through a camera with a long lens poking through the shrubbery.
"To get any definition, I need a few more yards."
His companion slowly crawled forwards, a narrow-beamed torch pointing low to the ground so that those ahead couldn't see its light. He signalled to the photographer to follow him. After a few steps, he heard a dull thud, followed by a gasping sound.
"Fuck's sake, Brocky, you clumsy bastard," he said, flicking his torch at the man behind him. "And get down, these buggers'll see you."
Brocky had dropped his camera and was now standing to his full height, staring straight ahead.
"Get down!"
This was a shouted whisper from the man in front, who shaded his torch with a gloved hand and directed the diminished beam towards Brocky. Dark blood oozed from the photographer's mouth as he fell forwards, his full length crashing heavily onto his companion. As the journalist tried to wriggle free from under the dead photographer's weight, his call for help was stopped in his throat. Chapter 6 Daly sat in the back of the large police car with Symington as they made their way down the steep, well-lit driveway that led from Cursivay House and turned onto the narrow single-track roadway leading back to the village. They had spent some time interviewing Percy and various family members already gathered in the house after speaking with Ailsa Shannon.
"I bloody hope I'm as sharp when I'm 80," said Symington.
"Yes, just shows what pots of money can do for your longevity," replied Daly,
whose own mother had died in her 60s. The cancer that killed her left undiagnosed until it was too late.
"Very cynical, if you don't mind me saying. Some folk are just lucky, DCI Daly. Evidently she's had her fair share of tragedy."
Daly was about to reply when his mobile phone buzzed in his pocket. "I'm in the county. Mine's a ginger beer and lime. Sad face. B." Daly smiled.
"Have you met D.S. Brian Scott yet, Mum?"
"No, not face to face, but I feel as though I have after reading so much about him."
"Well, once seen, never forgotten, I—"
Before Daly could finish what he was saying, the car sloughed sideways and came suddenly to a halt, propelling the police officers forwards in their seatbelts with a screech of brakes.
"What is it, Paul?" Daly shouted to the young constable who was driving. "Something lying in the road, sir. I think I managed to miss it."
All three unbuckled their seatbelts and got out of the car, walking back the few yards to the black shape huddled under the moonlight. Daly took his torch from his pocket and shivered. To his left, over the sea wall, dark waves broke on the beach.
"It's a body,"
said Symington, squinting into the beam cast by Daly's torch.
"I need to find out if he's still alive.
Here, son, hold this,"
said Daly, handing his torch to the constable.
"I didn't hit him, sir, I'm sure of it. You know yourself, we would have heard the thump."
Daly gently rolled the man onto his back, but before he could search for a pulse, he recoiled. The man's eyes had been gouged out, and his ears roughly hacked off. His mouth appeared to be a gaping black hole, devoid, Daly saw, of tongue or teeth. He felt the bile rise in his throat.
"Superintendent Symington here," he heard behind him. "I don't know how far on Socco are with the skeleton, but I want them and all available officers on the roadway at Cursivay House in Blan as soon as. Body at this locus. Foul play strongly suspected. Rouse the force doctor too."
She ended the call.
"Do we know who this is?"
"With the mutilation, it's too hard to say, ma'am,"
said Daly, still swallowing back the bile in his throat.
"Hold on."
He reached into the inside pocket of the blood-soaked jacket and found what he was looking for.
"Whoever did this, they weren't trying to conceal the identity of the victim,"
he said, flourishing a leather wallet. "Give me the torch." The wallet contained the usual array of bank cards, loose coins and notes. Daly fished a pink plastic card out of its holder.
"Bloody hell, I know him," he said, studying the driving license under the torchlight. "Ian Brocky. He used to be a snapper for the Glasgow News. He's been freelance for the last few years, paparazzi work, that kind of stuff. What the fuck is he doing here?"
"The Shannons?" asked Symington. "When it comes to the business community, they're as high profile as it gets."
Daly stared back down at the corpse, then at Symington, who was still looking at it intently. One thing he knew for sure about his new boss: she had a stronger stomach than he did. As Scott jumped back behind the wheel of his car in the county hotel car park, he reflected on the various merits and demerits of staying sober. Normally, after the long drive to Kinloch,
He'd have sunk into a bottle of whiskey and been neither fit to drive nor recall himself to duty.
"Lucky me," he said to himself, as he watched the first fat flakes of snow fall under the streetlights.
He'd been surprised at how easy it had been to stop drinking. Well, after the first few days, that was, when he thought his world was coming to an end. He had been doped up with some not strictly prescription medication, and his wife's homemade broth to take away the pain. It hadn't worked.
As the first week passed, though, things got easier, and soon he managed to regain some of his old cheer.
He had been left with a couple of problems, though, a nagging anxiety that gnawed at him every second of the day, and, worse still, strange flashes, visions, call them what you will. For seconds at a time he would see faces, shapes, movement in the darkness. Rather than have this on his medical record, he visited the Glasgow mortuary, where his old friend, pathologist Andy Crichton, had given it to him straight.
"Delirium tremens, Brian, more commonly known as the DTs," declared Crichton, in the same matter-of-fact way he spoke when dissecting a body. "The way you were drinking, it's lucky that's all you have. With a bit of luck, this will pass, if you stay off the bottle. Go back on it, though, and who knows where you'll bloody well end up. We've all seen those gibbering wrecks that hang around the streets of this city. Buggered, every one of them. And if it's not the booze, it's drugs. You've stopped imbibing in the nick of time, old boy."
These words had echoed around Scott's head ever since. He hated the feeling of imminent calamity, the shadow that moved at the corner of his eye as he was lying in the darkness trying to get to sleep. He hadn't told his wife, and he certainly hadn't informed anyone at work, including Daly. As he drove out of Kinloch and took the road to Blan, Crichton's words reverberated in his head again.
"I hate to tell you, but before these things get better, they can often get worse. So if the hallucinations become more real, or you start to feel more anxious, my advice is to visit your GP, regardless of the consequences. Fingers crossed, you'll be fine, though," he said, ending his dire warning on a bright note. "Aye, fine. Nae bother to me, Andy," Scott said under his breath, keeping his eyes on the road as the snow became heavier. "Here's me off to stare at another poor deed bastard."
The pub in Notting Hill Gate was busy with revellers who had just about got over Christmas and were now getting warmed up for New Year's Eve. Amidst the smart suits and party frocks, the laughter, song and high spirits, sat a man at a table on his own, swilling the last drops of an expensive whisky in a small glass. He checked the time on his watch, then sighed, looking up towards the side door of the hostelry. He felt the phone vibrate in the pocket of his jacket. "Dad, please call me. Something has happened. We need to talk." He put the phone back, shaking his head. "Not now, darling," he said beneath his breath, lifting his glass towards the barman, who acknowledged his request for another drink with a smile and a nod. As he scanned the room once more, he marvelled at how sophisticated young women looked these days compared to his youth in the 80s. They even appeared to be physically different. Tall, thin and elegant, not the bustling girls with the big hair he had been used to then. Maybe it was just his age and the realization that he could no longer turn the heads of beautiful young women, unless they knew how much money he had, that was. He was entering middle age, kicking, screaming, and hating every minute of it. He was momentarily mesmerized by the shapely behind of a dark-haired beauty as she bent forwards to pick up the bag at her feet. But his thoughts soon reverted back to the real reason he was here, the meeting with the man who could change his life. He gave the barman another £20 note and told him to keep the change. Just as he was taking the first sip of Springbank malt whiskey, the face he had been looking for appeared through the huddle of drinkers.
"Where have you been, you bugger?"
he said, standing to greet his visitor, raising his voice in order to be heard over the din of the pub.
"Traffic in this city," replied the newcomer, "makes Boston look like a village. So this your favourite watering hole?" "Nice," he said,
looking around the crowded bar and smiling at the dark-haired girl, who smiled back magnificently, showing a full set of snow-white teeth and fetching dimples. That was the trouble with being an ageing womanizer, thought Bruce. Eventually the day comes when the come-to-bed eyes flutter at someone else. In this case, that someone else was Trenton Casely.
"Time for that later, Trenton baby. I want to know how much money you're going to make me first." "Well, as to that, it all depends how much Shannon International Holdings you can get me, buddy. Oh, I think it's fair to say that we'll be looking at a controlling share. You're talking 51%? Got it in one, Trent. As long as you keep to your side of the bargain with my cousin, we're home and dry." "That's one of the reasons I wanted to meet you tonight in person, Bruce," said Casely. "I want you to realize that once this ball starts rolling and we put in place what we've discussed, there is no way back." He lowered his voice, moving closer to Bruce. "This thing happens, or we stop happening. Do you get me?"
He paused for a heartbeat, looking straight into Shannon's eyes as he nodded in agreement.
"Good, good. Just let me make a call, okay?" "Be my guest. In the meantime, I'll get us a couple of bottles of champagne, and we'll see if we can't catch a few of the pretty fish in this little pool." "That would be a most welcome diversion," replied Casely, eyeing the dark-haired girl again. "I'm sure the champagne corks will be popping in New York, too, once I've passed on the news."
Bruce watched him weave his way back towards the door, making time to brush against the girl, who beamed at him.
"Prick," muttered Bruce. "Go on, you get the girl," he thought. "Perform all the bedroom gymnastics you desire. Been there, done that many, many times, my friend. Just make sure you can deliver on your side of the bargain."
Bruce sat back in his chair and signaled to the barman again. Soon he would be a billionaire in his own right. He could do as he pleased and not have to listen to his patronizing cousin or hang on the petticoat tails of his overbearing mother. And he would never have to visit that bloody house on the cliff again.
"Yeah, shag that bint to your heart's content, Trent, my boy. See if I give a toss," he whispered to himself. "Then let more of the fine malt whiskey do its job."
Chapter 7.
"Pleased to meet you, ma'am," Scott said hesitantly, as he shook the hand of his new superior.
"You too, dear Scott. As I said to DCI Daily, I feel as though I know you already."
"Eh, aye, well, doesn't it to be putting too much faith in they files, ma'am? A lot of that stuff was written by your predecessor, if you know what I mean."
"We'll draw a line under that, shall we?"
replied Symington with a weak smile. Daly was busy directing uniformed cops as they sealed the roadway on either side of the corpse, now being lifted into the back of a private ambulance by the forensic team. Snow already covered the scene, cloaking the officers and road alike as they worked in the beams of police car headlights.
"This is all we need," muttered Scott, as he brushed more snow from the sleeve of his jacket. "I've never seen snow here before."
"Really?" remarked Symington. "I thought Scotland was snow central, well, as far as the UK is concerned."
"No here, apparently. Something to do with a Gulf Stream and it being a peninsula, ma'am."
"Quite the meteorologist."
"No, not me, ma'am," said Scott, looking heavenward. "Can't I say I know much about they meteors and asteroids and that?"
"No, meteorologist as in the weather," she replied.
She was about to expand upon this when Daly reappeared in a flurry of snow.
"That's everything secured and the remains in the Soko ambulance, ma'am. I've detailed three constables to stay here. Two of them will draw firearms from Kinloch. We'll have our rural boys patrol the village tonight until we can get something more substantial organized tomorrow. I'll need to call on reinforcements from division, ma'am."
"Quite the baptism of fire for me,"
observed Symington, raising her brow.
"Two bodies in one night. I have to say, I didn't expect this."
"At least I'm knowing a boat,"
said Scott. "I agree with the steps you've taken, DCI Daly, but I'd like someone with a bit of clout up at the house tonight. You'll have your hands full getting things moving at the office."
She looked at Scott.
"I want you to stay at Cursivay House tonight, D.S. Scott. Everything has to be kid gloves as far as this is concerned. I've already had the ACC on the phone."
"Like you said, ma'am, where there's wealth there are any number of potential problems," said Daly.
"Yes, though I hadn't envisaged anything of this magnitude."
"Don't let anything surprise you down here, ma'am," said Scott. "Fortunately, I never got the chance to take my case out of the back of the car in Kinloch, so I'm good to go."
"Good. I'll get back up there and tell the Shannons what's been going on. You come with me, dear Scott. I'll see you back in Kinloch, DCI Daly."
"No another pompous bastard," said Scott, as he watched her walking towards her car.
"Don't think so, Bri," replied Daly. "She's got something about her.
Aye, a crown on her shoulder and a gold band on her bonnet. That place up on the hill gies me the creeps. I wasn't fixing on spending the night there with the Adams family."
"All part of life's rich tapestry, Brian. I'd better go and get things moving down the road."
Scott watched Daly walk away into the snow and shivered.
"Right now," he thought, "I would give my left bollock for a dram."
He sighed, and followed his new superintendent. Veronica Moore woke with a start, her chest tight with anxiety from the nightmare. Her husband wasn't in their bed, so she squinted at the bedside alarm clock, which read 0322 in bold red letters. She stretched, and decided that she needed a cup of chamomile tea to calm her nerves. Not that the nightmare was new to her. She had the same one almost every night. She slid out of bed and wiggled her feet into her slippers, wondering where her husband was. Probably in his study, she reasoned, working on his Hogmanay sermon, or writing his book about the history of Blan, his pet project. He was a night owl, so his not being in bed at this time was not unusual. As she padded down the stairs, she noticed light escaping from under the door of the study. She was about to go in and ask Iggy if he would like a cup of tea, when she heard him speaking in low tones, his familiar voice deep and resonant. She stood for a moment, listening, then walked into the kitchen, a frown on her face. When she returned to bed, despite the chamomile tea, she couldn't get back to sleep. Veronica tugged at the little crucifix at her neck and stared into the darkness. Maxwell Shannon was dressed in a casual suit with an open-necked shirt. He had a floppy quiff of flaxen hair that, though he was now in his mid-40s, made him seem younger, and a patronizing attitude that belonged in another century.
"I have 2 points to make, Sergeant Scott. Firstly, I should have been informed of this bloody skeleton's appearance before my elderly aunt. Secondly, though I welcome the presence of your men in and around the grounds of the house, there is no need for you to spend the night on the premises. We have very able security people here with us. Isn't that right, Neville?" he said, nodding to a large man sitting in the chair behind him.
"That is absolutely correct, sir," replied the man, in a distinct Cockney accent. "There is no chance of anyone getting near Mr. Shannon or the rest of the family, I can assure you, Sergeant."
Scott hesitated for a moment, contemplating calling Daly and letting him know that the Shannon family had brought its own muscle, but decided against it at the last moment.
"I have my orders, Mr. Shannon, so if you don't mind, I'd just as rather you find me somewhere to lay my head," he said, looking around the large ballroom they were in. "In a place this size, there can't be a lack of space."
"It would surprise you, Sergeant. There are a lot of people here for the meeting already, who all have to be catered for. However, I suppose it's too late to change your orders at this time of night." He turned to the burly man behind him. "Neville, take the detective here to Percy. Tell him he needs a corner for the night."
As Scott followed the large man from the room, Shannon called back to him.
"You didn't tell me why I wasn't informed about the discovery of these remains. Before my aunt, I mean."
Scott stopped and turned around. "I wasn't here, sir, but it seems to me, if I understand things correctly, this incident may have a connection to Mrs. Shannon's son who disappeared 50 years ago. Am I right?" "Yes." "Well, I would hope that answers your question, sir."
Without another word, Scott turned on his heel. Daly looked out from his glass box within the CID suite at Kinloch Police Office. One search of the web had produced all he could ever want to know about the Shannons and their business, from humble beginnings in Blan to the largest private company on the planet. It was a tale of success piled upon success. He happened upon some old newspaper reports about the abduction of Archie Shannon in the '60s. An inset picture showed the young boy with his mother, an attractive woman whom Daly recognised immediately. Ailsa had retained her elegance in old age, but had been a real looker when she was young. The story was a tragic one, ending in the death of her husband a few years after the disappearance of her son. As he wound his way through the search results, he came upon details about the company's massive mineral contracts in China and Russia. These contracts had insulated the company against the recent global financial meltdown. In fact, they had profited from it, managing to eat up some vulnerable blue-chip companies, as well as buying up large portions of international banks desperate for cash. All in all, it was a story of unmitigated, almost unprecedented, business success. He looked at a picture of Maxwell Shannon, interim boss, while his father suffered from crippling ill health. Even the image of him in the still photograph exuded an arrogant confidence. He found little about Ailsa, apart from a cookbook she had written in the '70s, no doubt contrived as a sop to keep her occupied while the Shannon men got down to the real business in hand. For some reason, Daly found this hard to reconcile with the woman he had met. He doubted that it had been easy to keep Ailsa Shannon in a box over the years. He looked through the window to the room beyond. The process he'd witnessed too many times was gearing up once more. Up went the clear boards with photographs of the dead and the places they'd been found, the same spidery writing in red pen clinically labelling these gruesome images, the same buzz as detectives and uniformed cops began to analyse the death of another poor soul. For an instant, Daly thought about trying to work out the body count of the dead he'd had to deal with since becoming a policeman, but quickly decided against it. The simple answer was that it was far too many. Hopefully, most probably, in fact, this would be his last murder inquiry. And then what? It saddened him that he was worried about leaving this parade of corpses for want of something else to do. Surely he was worth more than this. Surely he could do something that didn't involve dealing with the very worst humanity could dish up. The questions echoed in his mind, until a knock at his door thrust him back into the present. "May I come in, sir?" asked D.C. Mary Dunn. "Yes, yes, of course," he replied, sitting up straighter and pulling in his stomach. Since Liz and James Daly Jr. had moved back to Kinloch, his working relationship with his young D.C. and ex-lover had been strained. He had done his best to be as professional as possible, treating her like any other officer under his command. There was no doubt, however, that losing her from his life had cast a shadow he had not expected. He had been so devoted to Liz, and for so long, that he found the ache of missing another as strange as it was heart-wrenching. Though he was loath to admit it, it was one of the reasons he had refused to reconsider his resignation. "I know this is a bad time, sir," she said, now sitting across the desk from Daly.
"I think you'll find that when it comes to our job, it's always a bad time."
He gave her a neutral smile.
"I need some time off."
"How long?"
"Just a couple of days, sir. I know that I have a few left from my allocation."
Daly suddenly remembered the trip to Paris with the young doctor she'd been seeing since they split up. He also remembered his insane jealousy
and how hard it had been to hide it from Liz.
"It's not a good time, you know, considering what's just happened. I have a new boss. I have to keep things straight."
"I have a hospital appointment," she said, staring at him with a detached expression.
"Oh, yes, right. Well, not a problem. When do you want to go?"
"It's in Glasgow, so if I could have the 5th and 6th off, that should be fine."
"Okay," said Daly, making a note of her request. "How are you, anyway? I'm sorry, I haven't had a chance to—"
"I'm fine," she replied, as she got up and walked towards the door. "How's James and Mrs. Daly, of course?" Without waiting for an answer, she left, closing the door behind her.
"This is the only room available," said Percy, somewhat petulantly. "Just a box room, really, but all we have." "Aye, thanks, mate," replied Scott, peering into the little room once Percy had switched on the light. "Mr. Shannon wasn't keen I was given a room at all. That English bastard! Honestly, I don't know what's happened to this family," he continued. "Bloody dandies and public schoolboys. Nothing like the way things used to be, you know. So you've been here for a long time. I've devoted my life to this shit," spat the old man. "No thanks. Piss-poor wages while they get richer and richer. I tell you, I'm not surprised things are coming home to roost." "What do you mean?" "Just what I say. Poor wee Archie. He was a nice little boy."
Scott studied the old man. His face was creased with wrinkles. Thin glasses perched on a nose tinged purple, which, along with the smell of fresh whiskey, marked out Percy as a heavy drinker.
"Doesn't he make you a bad person?" thought Scott. "What's the scoop with the door over there?" he asked, pointing to the room opposite, which was adorned with a wreath of red roses.
That's the boy's bedroom. Puts a wreath there every year. She's kept it the same for 50 years, not moved as much as a lamp. We keep it clean and aired, of course." "Bloody shame," said Percy. "I was fond of him."
"Would you mind if I had a look, bearing in mind what's been going on and all?" asked Scott.
"Eh, well, I suppose it won't do any harm. If the bones they found are his, well, things will change."
50 years is a long time to be wondering," said Scott, as he watched the old caretaker fiddle with a set of keys.
"At least you've got a good Scots tongue in your head," said Percy, opening the door.
Scott was taken aback. He felt as though he'd stepped straight back into his own childhood. An old-fashioned basket-weave lampshade hung above a bed covered in a cream candle-wick bedspread. The wallpaper pictured knights on horseback and men in armour with swords. On a small chair, a pair of jeans with a yellow and black snake belt sat neatly folded under a couple of knitted jumpers. A pile of old comics lay on the bedside table, their pages yellowed with age. Scott recognised the Eagle and the Beano. In short, it was a child's room from 50 years before, perfectly frozen in time, almost like a museum display.
"Fuck me," said Scott. "I always wanted a pair of denims with one of these snake belts. Harped on at my feyther for months. Did you get it?" "No. Ended up with moleskin trousers held up with my sister's skipping rope. Bloody great in the winter, but you ended up with right sweaty bollocks in the summer, I'll tell you. Aye, and we had to deal with second-hand comics, too, half of the pages missing or stuck together with snot. Trust me, my childhood was worse. Aye, those were the days." "He was the last hope for the family, you know," said Percy.
"What do you mean?" "Young Archie, the boy that went missing. There is another, but he's a waste of space. A lush like his father," continued Percy, almost to himself.
"Pot calling the kettle black," thought Scott, as the old man locked the door and they bid each other good night.
Chapter 8. Daly stretched before he put on his jacket. It was almost 2 a.m., and he had to get some sleep.
Tomorrow promised to be a challenging day. He left his glass box and said good night to the detectives manning the night shift. Outside the CID suite, the corridors of Kinloch Police Office were eerie in the subdued nightlights. He was about to leave via the back door into the car park when he heard footsteps behind him.
"I'm sorry, Jim. Sir, I didn't mean to be so abrupt earlier on," said Dunn, appearing from the shadows, nervously smoothing unseen creases in her trousers.
"Don't worry, my fault, not yours. I'm just sorry things... well, you know," replied Daly, sadly.
"I really hope it all works out, with Liz and the baby, I mean."
"Thanks. It's all going to be very different when I don't have a job to go to."
"I hope that's nothing to do with me. I had applied for a transfer, but then, well, Angus and I..."
"No, don't worry. Nothing to do with you," Daly lied. "I wonder if I should ever have been in this job in the first place. I'd certainly be a different person now if I hadn't had to look at all the horror and misery I've seen over the last few years. I can tell you that for nothing."
"Well, anyway, I'd better get back to it," she smiled wanly.
"Mary, I miss you. I..."
"Please don't. I'm with someone, and so are you. Good night."
She turned on her heel and ran back down the corridor. Daly sighed as he sat in his car. He felt his throat tighten, and his eyes started to sting. The empty feeling in his chest was one he was well accustomed to, even though the cause of it was new. Slowly he pulled out of the car park and onto the road. The road back home, to his wife and child. The song on the radio spoke of lost love under the lights that shone. He turned it off. Scott turned over in bed again. His bedtime reading had been the files and photographs on the Shannon family, sent from the police office to his smartphone. He was comfortable, warm, and certainly tired enough after his drive to Kinloch. Despite this, he found sleep hard to find. There was something about the house he didn't like. It was cold and austere, a house that wasn't a home. He wondered if anyone had ever really thought of it as that. He thought back to a visit to his great-aunt on the Isle of Mull. His mother had been unwell. Women's problems, his father had said. To temporarily remove the strain of bringing up two small boys, he and his brother were farmed out to reluctant relatives for the long summer holiday. With family unwilling to put up with two boisterous boys, he and his brother were split up. Charlie went to an uncle in Troon, while he, being the oldest, was put on the train from Glasgow to Oban, where an old woman met him. He'd never seen her before in his life, but she did have a distant resemblance to his mother, her niece.
"Aye, your feyther looking straight oot o' ye," she'd said.
He'd never really been on a boat before. He'd seen them ply their trade up and down the Clyde under the tall shipyard cranes, but he'd never been out to sea. It was an assault on the senses. The motion of the vessel and the tang of salt, mixed with fumes from the large funnels, made him miserably sick for the whole hour or so it took to reach the Isle of Mull. A rickety bus took him and his aunt on a journey that never seemed to end. Eventually they alighted at the end of a bumpy farm road.
"A mile or so and we'll be there," said his great-aunt, taking him by the hand.
They walked over a small hill, then along a rutted path. On top of another rise, Scott was able to look down onto a small valley, in the midst of which sat a low black cottage. It was blacker inside than out, lit by gas lamps and the huge fire that his aunt kept burning in the grate, despite the time of year. He spent a miserable few weeks with only the old woman for company, willing the long summer nights to last around the clock. The dark hours of night, though mercifully short, were the darkest he'd ever known. Unless the sky was clear, which it never seemed to be, and the moon shone, the whole house was black. He remembered thinking that this was what it would be like to be blind. The creaks and inexplicable noises of the night terrified him.
At home, he might be at risk of a clip around the ear from his father, or a bleaching from the big MacDougall boy down the street. But the young Brian Scott could cope with these things. What he couldn't cope with was the long Highland summer, where he could only sleep when the short night was over. Lying in his bed in Kersevay House, he felt the same way. Twice he'd used his radio to check in on the cops patrolling the grounds of the mansion. On both occasions, there'd been nothing to report. He knew he had to get some sleep, that he would be exhausted the next day otherwise. This was the way it had been since he stopped drinking. But this house made it worse somehow. "Bloody misery," he whispered to himself. He had started to doze on the edge of sleep when something roused him. He sat up in bed and listened. Nothing at first, but just as he was about to lie down, he heard it again. Footsteps, light and quick, like a child's running up and down the corridor outside his room. Typical. Bloody Waynes! He was wearing a pair of shorts and a T-shirt, and shivered as he levered himself out of the bed and away from the warmth of the duvet. He padded across the thick carpet, then opened the door and stepped out into the dim corridor. The cold almost took his breath away as he squinted into the gloom. "Looks like your central heating's burst, Percy," he mumbled. He was just stepping back into his room when he heard it, the soft tinkle of a child's laughter. He spun around. "Right, you wee bugger, where are you?" As his eyes adjusted to the darkness, he noticed with surprise that the door opposite, the one with the wreath of red roses, was lying open. "Ah, you stupid old bugger, you've no locked the thing right." He crossed the corridor, grabbing the handle of the door to pull it shut. As he did so, he heard the child's laugh again, this time coming from behind the door.
"Gotcha!"
Scott swung the door open and fumbled for the light switch, cursing when he pressed it and nothing happened. Then, in the darkness, something caught his eye. Sitting on the chair, on top of the folded denims and jumpers, was a tiny figure, a young boy staring straight at him. The breath caught in Scott's throat. He wanted to walk towards the child and remove him from the cold room, but he couldn't. Trying to speak, he watched as the boy stood up and walked slowly towards him.
"Hello. My name's Archie Shannon."
The boy reached out to him, but in that same instant was gone, leaving Scott alone in the cold, empty room, with his heart thudding in his ears, struggling for breath. Driving along Kinloch's main street, Daly noticed a figure walking slowly, huddled against the cold wind. Recognising the man, he stopped and wound down the passenger window.
"Hamish, bloody hell, you must be freezing. Come on, jump in."
The old man slid onto the passenger seat, bringing a blast of bitterly cold air into the warm car.
"What are you doing out on a night like this? It's bloody freezing," said Daly. "Oh, this time of year. I hate it. Never have liked the festive season."
Daly stared at him.
"Anything else wrong? You've got a face like a wet weekend."
"Just a feeling. Aye, and it won't go away. I had to get out of the house tonight. Just to break the spell, you understand?"
"What kind of feeling?"
"I don't know. Like something's no right with the world. I dare say you get it yourself from time to time. No rhyme or reason to it at all."
"I get feelings like that all the time, Hamish. But then again, I don't have your second sight."
Daly laughed, hoping the old man would join in. He didn't. Daly pulled the car up by Hamish's cottage on the outskirts of the town, by the side of the loch, with its island guardian looming in the darkness. The street lights far behind, he stared into the darkness.
"Hey, wait! Your front door's lying open, Hamish."
He jumped out of the car and walked up the narrow path. As he stepped inside and started groping for a light switch, he heard sudden movement from inside the room. Before he could swing round, something crashed into him, forcing his head hard against the wall. The blow stunned him, but the agony in his scalp was worse, tiny needles thrusting into his head. He cried, desperately trying to shake off his attacker.
"Hamish, help!" he yelled.
He felt pain in the back of his neck. Something sharp was piercing the skin.
"Here, you daft bastard!"
Suddenly the room filled with light, and with a blood-curdling screech the attack stopped, leaving Daly breathing hard, trying to take in what had just happened. He felt something running down his face, and, patting at it, saw that his hand was covered in blood.
"Bloody hell, Hamish! What the fuck?"
He looked around the room, now lit by a single bare bulb hanging from an old flex. Hamish's home had been trashed. The old man stood in front of Daly, keeping a huge striped cat at bay with a walking stick.
"Just you stay where you are, Hamish. There's nothing to worry about now, son," he said to the cat,
which was still squatting in an attack pose, ears flat against its head, hissing loudly. Scott shivered in his bed. He'd toyed with the idea of asking one of the cops on duty in the grounds of Kersevay House to come to his room, but thought the better of it. He then considered heading out into the grounds himself to meet one of his colleagues, but couldn't face walking out into the cold corridor again. He couldn't keep his limbs still. With trembling hands, he reached for his mobile, managing to steady the device enough to switch it on. Thankfully, he had a signal. He scrolled down his contact list until he came to the name Crichton. Awkwardly, he touched the screen and held the phone to his ear with both hands. Just as he was about to hang up, the call was answered.
"Brian Scott, what on earth is going on? It's just after 4 in the morning, man." "Listen, Watty, you've got to help me."
Scott quickly blurted out the details of what he had seen in the child's room.
"As I thought," replied Crichton testily. "It's the DTs that's reaching the psychotic stage. No bloody wonder after all the booze you've flung down your neck. How real did this all seem?" "Bloody real. I saw a boy. He fucking spoke to me, Watty." "Listen to me. I want you to calm down, take deep breaths. Think of something calming. Rangers winning the treble, for instance." "Steady on, Watty. I'm no that far gone yet. I've had enough hallucinations for one night." "There, see? You're calming down already. Take your time, Brian. Deep breaths."
Crichton continued to speak to Scott in quiet tones as, slowly, the detective regained some of his composure.
"Now listen to me, Brian. You're going to have to get medical help. You need something to calm you down, to stop these, well, experiences. You need to see a doctor. I'm in bloody Kinloch. Well, near there anyway. In the middle of fucking nowhere, in fact. It doesn't matter. This won't go away by itself. In fact, without treatment, it'll likely get worse. See a bloody doctor."
Scott apologized for waking his friend, then ended the call. He felt much calmer now, but still reckoned he'd wait until daylight before venturing out of his room. He propped himself up against some pillows and closed his eyes, willing sleep to come. Daly helped Hamish make the best of tidying his house.
"I just can't understand it, Mr. Daly. Who would want to do a thing like this? It's not as though I've got anything worth stealing."
"No," agreed Daly, "but I don't think this was your usual burglary."
"Well, what were they after?"
"Look, see this box of photographs, and the one in your bedroom, scattered as though they've been looked through. If your aim is to steal something of value, you're not going to sit down and go through the family albums before you do it, Hamish."
"Aye, right enough, I hadn't thought of that. But they're just old pictures. Some of them belong to my mother."
Daly answered the door to a young detective and a uniformed cop. "I want you to fingerprint the usual surfaces and see if you can pick up anything from these photos. There's more in the bedroom."
"Thanks for all your help, Mr. Daly," said Hamish. "I can't get my head around this at all."
"Looks like your premonition of something being wrong was spot on. Once the boys are finished in your bedroom, try and get some sleep. I'll make sure there's a cop at the door until we can make some kind of sense of this. In the morning, I want you to go through the photos and see if any are missing. And keep Hamish the cat under control. He could have had my eye out."
"Oh, he was just feared. It's his wild instincts coming out. He likely got a fright when they burglars were in. He's quite highly strung, you know."
"Yes, I've got the teeth marks in the back of my neck to prove it. Anyway, I want you to concentrate on what's missing, if anything.
"'Aye, nae bother, Mr. Daly. "'But I can tell you right now about one that's been stolen.'
"'How do you know?' "'He pointed above the mantelpiece to a rectangular patch of wallpaper, "'a lighter shade than the rest of the walls. "'What was the picture of, Hamish?'
"'My mother.'
"'A look of sadness passed over Hamish's wrinkled face.
"'She was just young when it was taken. "'Oh, a few years before I was born, I reckon.'
"'And who else was in the picture?'
"'Just her and a few of her workmates, "'as well as some of the folk for the big house.'
"'What big house?'
"'Where she worked in they days, Mr. Daly. "'She was in service at Kersevay House in Blan. "'Och, I'm sure you know it fine up there on the cliff. "'Great big rambling place.'
"'Oh, yes, I know it.'
"'I'm telling you,' Hamish sighed, "'the world's far from right tonight.' And that's a fact.
Daly walked to his car, pondering once more on Hamish's gift of prescience, as he watched the snow fall over Kinloch. Chapter 9 Colin Grant was cold, very cold. His whole body shook as he came to on the damp floor. Bound in a sitting position, his hands were tied to his ankles. His teeth chattered as the dim moonlight illuminated the space in a cold, thin light. He could hear the sound of waves crashing on a beach. The smell of the sea was strong, but overlaid by a dank, earthy smell. He tried to swallow, his tongue sticking to the roof of his dry mouth. Then the memory of seeing the steel point appear through the neck of his colleague Brocky came back to him. He started to scream, trying to shuffle forwards to the mouth of the cave, but he was manacled to something at his back, and any movement was impossible.
"'For fuck's sake, help me!' he shouted.
At his feet, moonlight glinted on puddles of ice on the floor of the freezing cave. Gulls squealed, and the sound of the sea grew louder in his ears. But Colin Grant's screams did not summon help. Eventually, only a croak emanated from his ruined throat, giving way to sobs. As he was about to lose all hope, he heard the crunch of footsteps on the pebbled beach. With all the force he could muster, he cried out again. A shadow loomed across the mouth of the cave. He tried to squint at the figure, but the bright sunlight obscured all features.
"'Please, help me,'
he said, straining at his bonds.
"'I have money. You can have anything. Please. Please!'
His pleas were cut short as something stung his chest, making him writhe in pain. Scott asked the officers who had patrolled the grounds of Kersevay House throughout the night to come to his room to make their reports. Nothing out of the ordinary had happened, but he made sure they accompanied him out of his room and down the corridor to the stairs. He hadn't dared leave the room by himself, though he was careful not to let his colleagues see his nervousness, cracking jokes as he walked past the door with the red wreath. Despite the presence of two constables, a shiver went up his spine. They were shown to a large dining room, where a long table had been set for breakfast.
"'Help yourselves,' said a plump old woman,
directing them to a table laden with an array of fruits, breakfast cereals, and pots of tea and coffee.
"'If yez would like a cooked breakfast, it'll be another few minutes.'
"'Oh, aye,' said Scott, suddenly ravenous. "'The full Scottish for me, dear.'
As the policemen took their seats at the table, Maxwell appeared in the doorway. He was wearing sweatpants and a white T-shirt, and was mopping his brow with the corner of a towel that lay draped across his shoulders. His large minder eyed the police officers with a look of distaste.
"'Ah, Sergeant Scott, as predicted, nothing untoward happened last night.'
"'Well, no, nothing of any significance, anyhow,' replied Scott.
"'Good. When can we expect the results of the tests on the skeleton?'
"'I don't have that information, sir. I'm sure someone will be in touch with Mrs. Shannon later today.'
"'As I said last night, I'm in charge here. I want to be the first to know of any developments.'
He poured himself a cup of coffee, but didn't sit at the table with the police officers.
"'On second thought, don't worry about it. I'll call your superior later this morning. I'm sure he'll see the sense in what I'm saying.'
I wouldn't be too sure of that, Scott mumbled under his breath.
Before Maxwell could reply, a young woman walked into the room. She looked to be in her late teens, pale, her hair cut into a bob. An older woman in a plain blue dress accompanied her.
"Well, well," said Maxwell. "May I introduce my cousin's daughter, Nadia?"
She smiled nervously at the policeman.
"I hope you've calmed down after last night's little episode," said Maxwell.
"If you don't mind, sir, Nadia just wants to have a quiet breakfast," said the woman in blue.
"Come and sit with us, dear,"
said Scott, pulling the seat beside him back. Maxwell smiled patronizingly as Nadia took a seat.
"Well, I must get on. I have a busy day ahead of me. If any of you gentlemen fancy a workout, there's a fully equipped gym in the basement. A little exercise wouldn't go amiss."
He looked pointedly at Scott, then leaned down towards Nadia. He leaned on her shoulder and whispered into her ear, loud enough, though, for everyone to hear what he was saying.
"No histrionics today, my dear. We have a lot of important guests."
He sneered at the young girl's obvious discomfort.
"Mrs. Watkins, make sure to keep her out of the way today."
"Yes, Mr. Shannon,"
she replied through gritted teeth. With his minder in tow, Maxwell strode out of the room without another word.
"He might have been to one of those public schools, but charm sure wasn't on the curriculum," observed Scott.
"He's the boss," said Mrs. Watkins. "Please don't let him put you off your breakfast."
"Ugh, don't worry about that," said Scott. "It'll take a wee bit more than Maxwell to put me off my scran this morning."
Nadia turned to Scott, her brown eyes sad.
"You see things, don't you?"
"Eh, sorry, lass, see what?"
said Scott, taken aback.
"You saw my uncle. You saw Archie Shannon. I see him too."
Suddenly Scott's appetite had gone. Maxwell sat behind the desk in his room, phone in hand.
"I don't care whether they're Scotch or Hindustani. I want them off my back. The whole thing is ridiculous. We have a perfectly adequate security team here. We don't need these jock plods all over the bloody place. Just attend to it, or you'll have to survive on your wages from the Met. And with your lifestyle, I reckon that will be nothing short of a disaster."
He slammed the phone down, breathing heavily. Nothing, not even the bones of his long-dead cousin, was going to ruin this. It was his time. In a few days, he would be in full control of one of the largest companies on Earth, one of the largest business enterprises in the history of humanity. He picked up the phone again.
"Is everything in place? For the meeting, I mean."
He listened to the brief reply.
"Just make sure that it goes the way we want."
Daly barely slept through the short hour's rest available to him. He thought of the Shannons, of the missing boy from so long ago, of the white bones on the dark stone, of the disfigured face of the photographer. Here he was again, being flung headfirst into a pool of mayhem, murder and horror. It was as though the fates were pulling out all the stops to make his last weeks in the job as difficult as possible. Thoughts of the future plagued him too. He had slept in the spare room to avoid waking his wife and baby son. How was he going to support them? How was he going to pay the bills? How was he going to spend the rest of his working life? What was going to replace the police force? Then there was Symington, neat, efficient, and focused, but not without a sense of humour. She was so different from John Donald. There was something about her that reminded Daly of himself, a reticence, almost intangible, but there just the same. What manner of ghosts kept her awake at night, he wondered. And Mary. He could see her soulful face, her pleading blue eyes. He knew the sadness he had brought into her life, because he felt it too. He looked at his alarm clock, dragged himself out of bed and padded to the shower. His career as a detective wasn't over quite yet.
Suddenly Colin Grant was awake. He was naked, kneeling, his hands tied above his head to some kind of frame. He shivered in the rising sun, with fear as well as cold. He was facing out to sea, his knees firmly planted in the pebbles of a beach. A few feet in front of him, a gull pecked at the shale, undisturbed by his plight.
"For fuck's sake, what is this?"
he yelled.
"What are you doing to me?"
He had the sense that someone, something, was behind him, out of sight. As the wind buffeted him and blew in his ears, he was sure he could hear breathing. He scanned the grey ocean. No vessel was to be seen. To his left was a white hill covered with snow, as were boulders on the beach just within his line of sight. He cried out again, before he heard footsteps on the pebbles behind him.
"Who are you? What the fuck are you trying—"
His words were cut short by a sudden blinding agony. Something was sliding down his back. Something was slicing him open. Daly was surprised to find Scott sitting in his glass box when he arrived for work. "Everything okay, Brian? You look pale."
"Aye, aye, Jim, just fine. We're just back for the House of Horrors there. By fuck, the road's bad with snow. It's not as bad here in the toon, but at Blan it's deep."
Daly looked out at the sky from the window in the CID suite. It had the pale grey look that presaged heavy snow.
"It could still be a problem."
He turned to look back into the busy office, noting a few strange faces. Clearly Superintendent Symington had already drawn down help from division.
"Have you met Maxwell Shannon yet?" asked Scott.
"No, he wasn't there when the boss and I turned up. What's he like?"
"Piece of shit, Jimmy. Arrogant bastard. He's no happy that you went to see his aunt and know him. Demands to be the first to hear any news about the remains found on that stone."
"Ah, well, wanting and getting are two different things, Bri. I read a file on him yesterday. Looks like the typical spoiled rich kid, you know. Secret societies at university, trashing restaurants and pubs. Allegation of sexual assault when he was 18, but nothing came of it in the end. Aye, don't tell me. The lassie withdrew her complaint." "Bang on, buddy. Unlike his cousin Bruce, he doesn't drink now."
"Good for him," replied Scott,
the thought of a large glass of whisky passing through his mind. "Nothing on that stone yet?"
"What? Oh, the bones. They should have news by mid-morning, according to one of the night shift boys. We've got something else to worry about, though."
"What? As well as a child's remains and the body of a mutilated press photographer?"
"Aye, Brocky was working freelance for one of the tabloids. We had a journalist. Colin Grant, the guy's name is. They were trying to get as much shit on this Shannon family as they could."
"Let me guess, the guy's disappeared and he's not answering his phone."
"Got it in one, big man."
"Brilliant." Daly was about to ask more about Grant when the door to his glass box swung open.
"Just to let you know, sir, reports of 4 housebreakings last night," said Sergeant Shaw. "Mostly in Kinloch, one near Blan."
"What, including Hamish's?"
"No, sir, he's number 5.
"Bugger me, Jim, we've got a crime wave. This on top of everything else."
"Yes, strange, isn't it? Just when all this is going on. Try and find out what, if anything, has been taken during these break-ins, Sergeant. Oh, and ask particularly about pictures or photographs."
Scott looked puzzled. "I'll explain in a minute," said Daly, thinking about the blank space above Hamish's mantelpiece.